This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Thanks for jumping in, everyone, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Calder with you this week, riding solo, it would appear, with no high-performance coaches this week, but we do have a special guest, which we'll get into in a second. I hope everyone's doing well out there in lockdown land. I understand we're all at that point where, unfortunately, the seasons have been cancelled for VJBL, Big V, and NBL1, which a real shame, but obviously understandable given the situation we're in at the moment, and everyone's hopefully going to start preparing for the following season, whenever that can be as well. So please do make sure you make an effort to reach out to your athletes and other coaches in the community as well. It is a little bit of a tough time for everyone at the moment, so the more we can connect with each other, I think the better that will be when we all are able to get back on court, which I know everyone's itching to do at the moment. As always, we do appreciate any likes, shares, retweets, all those kinds of cool things that you get to do with the podcast as well. Ratings and reviews are very much appreciated, so if you've got the time to do that, that would be fantastic for us as well. As I mentioned, we do have a special guest this week. Mid-semester break at La Trobe University, our guest has managed to jump in for us, which is huge because I know she's a very busy person. Dr. Alex Roberts, who has written a thesis on the coach's eye, which looks into exploring decision-making during talent identification. We'll link to the thesis in the show notes if anyone is interested to go and have a look at that. She is also on the Executive Advisory Board for the Women's Coaches Association. And again, we'll link to that in the show notes as well if you are interested in having a little bit of a look at what they're doing in that space as well. So really lucky to have with us from La Trobe University, Dr. Alex Roberts into the podcast this week. Alex, can you give us a little bit of an understanding as to what your sport experience was like growing up? You know, where did you specialise, generalise, and where it took you in the end?
So I grew up on the Gold Coast, was lucky enough to go to a school where they really encouraged us to do a little bit of everything. So I grew up mostly playing, I started playing hockey when I was about three. Grew up doing that, playing a bit of everything at school, basketball, netball, tennis. I think I played volleyball one season, a little bit of everything. And then as I got into high school, started playing water polo and also rowing. So I end up towards, yeah, sort of the end of high school, I was doing those three sports, so hockey, water polo, and rowing at a fairly high level. So sort of, you know, state representative across those three sports. And then I actually ended up being lucky enough to get a scholarship to go over to the US. So I got a rowing scholarship to a Div 1 university. So I got to go and have that whole college athlete experience, which was really great. And I think that my generalization across a bunch of sports really helped that.
Yeah. Was that always the plan? Like, was that a goal of yours to get over to the States, or was that just something that happened?
Never. When I went, I'd never heard of anyone going. That was kind of before that was a pathway for Australian athletes. I went to the University of Queensland for about a year, and I was trying to do the whole elite level athlete and university at the same time. That was, you know, 10, 12 years ago now. So before elite athlete programs existed at universities, there was no inbuilt support. I was really struggling with keeping up with both my high level rowing and all my academics. And then someone said to me, oh, you know that you can go to the US and they'll give you a scholarship to, you know, do both, and they'll, you know, support you academically and, you know, even give you a little bit of spending money. I was like, what? That's just unheard of. What are you talking about? And then 4 months later, I was on a plane. Wow. It all happened really quickly, was never part of the plan. I enjoyed rowing and I wanted to see how far I could take it. And that happened to be the next step. So
that's unreal. Very kind of your parents to get you started on hockey as a three-year-old. Like, I don't know that I'd be giving too many three-year-olds a hockey stick to just wander around.
That runs in the family.
Excellent. You're all good then. No problems on that end. So was the college experience what you anticipated it would be?
Not at all. Yep. I didn't really, as I said, didn't really know what I was getting into because I didn't know anyone else who'd done it. I'd never even heard of it. You know, sure, I'd seen on TV that these kids were trying to get athletic scholarships, but, you know, what does that actually mean? So got over there, had no idea what to expect. Didn't realize that I was going into what was technically a 20-hour a week practice period, but it actually ends up being closer to 30 or 40 by the time, you know, everything's said and done. Just the American university system works very differently to what ours does here. Things like, you know, you have to actually show up to class, whereas here, a lot of the time your teachers don't care. As long as you turn your assignments in, they're not checking whether you're showing up to lectures, but in the States they are. Just a lot of things that, again, I didn't know what I was getting into, didn't really have my head around, and probably didn't have it all explained to me, the expectations at the same level that I probably would have needed to. There was a lot of assumed knowledge from the university perspective because, you know, yes, they get international students, but, you know, they kind of assume that you just know what you're getting into. And yeah, I very much didn't. So I had a good experience over there overall. I ended up getting injured and that ended my rowing career, unfortunately. But yeah, on the whole, just, yeah, didn't really know what I was getting into. Had I known what I was getting into, I probably still would have done it. It was a great experience. But I probably would have gotten more out of it just knowing, yeah, what was expected of me and been able to prepare for that better.
Yep, absolutely. That's something a lot of our basketball kids obviously deal with a lot. We have a lot of international kids that go across and play in the college thing. And it's amazing how many kids don't survive the 4 years. They'll transfer after one or two because they're probably not quite across everything. Like, are you going to the right climate? Are you going to the right coach? Are you in the right system? Those kinds of things. It's just something that's probably not really taken into account by a lot of our junior athletes.
Yeah, it's something we talk about a lot is that whole idea of, you know, holistic athlete development. We need to think about people as being more than athletes. But when we're looking at things like, you know, going to study internationally or whatever, the only thing people look at is the program. You know, for basketball, I want to go to the University of Kentucky because it's, you know, the number one program in the country or whatever. But you don't look at the academics. You know, can I handle the academics? You know, as a student athlete, am I somebody who wants to go somewhere with a really rigorous academic program? What do I want to get out of my degree? You know, or am I somebody that really couldn't care less about the academics and that's just a pathway for me to continue my sport? And yeah, those kind of things really need to be taken into account. But again, we don't consider it. We're so focused on the sport that we forget about the lifestyle that's going to go with it.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. So, I mean, you spoke about getting injured. Did that then open the door into coaching for you? Is it something you always considered or is it just the byproduct of what happened?
So I've always coached. I couldn't tell you the first time I coached, but I would have been, you know, 12, 13, helping out with some of the junior squads. So it's always something that I've been very interested in. I come from a family of teachers, so it was probably always fairly inevitable. But then, yeah, once I finished rowing, that freed up a lot of my time. I was no longer training 20, 30, 40 hours a week. And that gave me the opportunity to get back into coaching, which is something that when I moved to the States, I stopped doing. I didn't have time with everything. So yeah, that really gave me the opportunity to get back into coaching and coaching basically at a high school level that I really enjoyed doing. And that sort of reminded me that I do enjoy coaching and that sport wasn't closed to me anymore. Cause yeah, after my injury, I couldn't walk for a while, things like that. So sport felt like it was something that was now completely lost to me, except in an academic sense. But yeah, so getting into coaching really just opened that up to me again and sort of led me into where I am now with my research.
Was it a little bit of a, you fell out of love with the sport a little bit when you got an injury and it's like, geez, I don't know that I can go back to this, or was it that itch was always there to continue coaching?
I took a little bit of time off after my injury. I had to, you know, work through some emotions. I was angry. I was sad. All of those, you know, stages of grieving. But came back to sport pretty quickly. I tried to get back into rowing, but quickly realized that I'm far too competitive to do it at the level that I'm now capable of doing it. I can't push myself as hard as I inevitably do and then get injured again. So coaching was a nice way to sort of scratch that itch, that competitive, I still want to do it. I still want to get better. I still want to help other people get better. And this way I can do it without, again, putting myself in harm's way.
Yeah, that's the important part of coaching is stay out of injuries. It's why most people coach, I find. So you spoke about your research and your study and everything that goes with that. So the coach's eye was your thesis that you wrote on exploring coach decision-making during talent identification. And talent ID is a real beast of a topic. When you talk to anyone, it's, you know, are you in the right situation to get identified? Are you even picking the right people as a coach? Everything that goes with it. How did you come to this topic to write your thesis on?
So it's something I've always been really interested in, probably from when I was at school. How I got into rowing was that I got talent ID'd into rowing. That was back when the AIS was doing like those talent search things where they'd come around to your school and, you know, they'd, you know, measure your height and weight and wingspan and get you doing a bunch of exercises and then send you a letter at the end saying, we think you're highly matched to this sport, come along, have a go, all that kind of thing. And so at that time, I'd already been rowing for 12 months, but I was terrible at it. I was doing it because one of my teachers had said, hey, you're tall. I was 12 years old and 6 foot. So she was like, you are coming to do rowing, whether you like it or not. Did it for 12 months, was awful at it. This AIS thing came around and they actually identified me into kayaking. So I went along to my first kayaking session with this talent coach. He put me in a kayak, took a look at me and went, maybe rowing. and then that sort of, I guess, gave me the boost I needed within rowing to stick with it, because I'd been just about to quit because, again, I was terrible. But then I think that was just sort of the switch that made me go, oh, okay, someone thinks I could actually be good at that. And then, you know, within 6 months of that, I was winning state championships. Within 12 months, I was, you know, making, you know, state squads. You know, when I was 13, 14, I'm making the senior or the under 18 state squads and things like that. So, that just really fascinated me, in this whole idea of talent ID, that somebody could see something in me that I couldn't see and that nobody else had, and that it was based on more than purely my physicality. Just the fact that I was tall wasn't the only reason they were telling me I'd be good at this sport. So that really fascinated me. And then I just happened to get really lucky that the AIS was looking for someone to come and do some research on the coach's eye in talent ID. Just happened to be in the right place at the right time. They paid me to do my PhD for 4 years and to look at this idea, of the coach's eye and how coaches are able to see this talent in people before the person is actually expressing that talent.
Yep. So there's an awful lot of luck that goes into talent ID, of course. I mean, you cannot even measure that thing as to what that looks like. But even in your situation, like, had the AIS not come to your school, ID'd you as being the right physical sort of makeup to be able to be a rower, had the coach at kayaking not said, actually, you're probably better suited to rowing, all these sorts of sliding door moments can really make a difference. And that little bit of belief was probably what kicked you into gear, I suppose, to say, actually, I want to do this.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I can't say that that's exactly what happened. I don't remember sitting down and being like, yes, I can now do this. But it was definitely the thing that, you know, made me say, all right, I'll stick it out for another 6-12 months and I'll see what happens. And yeah, it happened.
No, exactly. So what's your definition of talent identification?
So depends on how you want to look at it. But basically, I see talent ID as being a process. A lot of people, when you say talent ID, they view it as kind of a snapshot. So come along to our talent ID day and we'll tell you if you're talented or not. I view it as really being a process. So it's a series of steps that coaches go through throughout an athlete's development. So talent ID, again, I view it as being that long-term process made up of a bunch of different steps. And one of those steps is this idea of forecasting, which is probably what most people are really thinking about when they're thinking talent ID. I'm seeing someone now and I'm forecasting, or I'm predicting how well I think they're going to go in the future. That if all goes according to plan and they don't get injured, there's none of these chance issues, you know, they end up with the right coaches. As you said, there's so many luck aspects involved in it. But if everything goes according to plan, you could be an NBA player one day. You could be an Olympic gold medalist one day. That is that forecasting aspect. But the forecasting can happen very short term, or it can happen really long term. So I'm looking at a 12-year-old and I can say, I think you'll be an Olympic medalist one day, or I think you'll play in the NBA or on the Boomers or whatever. Or I can forecast that if I teach you this skill in 6 months, you'll be scoring double the amount of points in a game that you are right now. So those forecasts can be really short or long term. But again, when we're talking talent ID, we're really looking for that long term. We're trying to figure out what it is about this athlete that is going to make them successful in the long term. Again, as opposed to that sort of snapshot, which is how we typically do talent ID. It's the best we've got at the moment, but it's not great.
Yep. So how much of that comes down to, say, the different, like, the physical, the mental, you know, just feel? Like, you, I know I'd certainly do it. Like, if you're a long, lanky left-hander and you play basketball and I'm one of the coaches, you can almost guarantee I'll pick that kid every time, because I've had a left-handed long athlete previously that was really successful that I enjoyed coaching. I've almost have a bias towards picking that sort of an athlete. Is there anything like that that you've seen in your studies as well?
Most definitely. So that's something that idea of kind of that bias. Bias typically has a negative connotation to it, which by the dictionary definition, it is technically negative. But there's something called heuristics, which is similar to that idea of bias, but it's not inherently good or bad. But that heuristic is what you just described. It's that idea of kind of a rule of thumb, in that if I see an athlete that's tall, lanky, and left-hand dominant, I'm probably going to pick them, or if not pick them, I'm at least going to pay more attention to them. That's what catches my eye, is that long, lanky left-handed. Other coaches, the thing that catches their eye might be the short athlete, the shortest one on the team, but who is just outplaying everybody else because they have to, because they're shorter, so they have to develop those skills. So I think that's something that happens across the board. I think any coach that tells you that they don't have this bias or don't rely on these heuristics, they're either lying to themselves or lying to you. Everybody does it. It's an inherent thing. And especially for something like talent ID, we rely on heuristics because they allow us to make decisions when we don't have enough time to do so, when we don't have enough information to do so, and in the kind of situation where the right outcome or the correct outcome is either unknown or unknowable. So again, we talk talent ID. We've got no way of knowing whether we're picking the right athletes or not. We can stand around and say, yes, this athlete was picked at 12 and they made it to the NBA. So obviously we picked correctly. Well, sure, but was there another athlete that we didn't pick that could have made it had they had the same opportunities? So we've got no way of knowing whether talent ID is accurate or not, which is why heuristics can be really handy. And I think they're really important for coaches as well, because coaches are the ones who are having to develop these athletes, right? You don't pick an athlete in a vacuum. You don't just pick someone and say, yep, you're going to be good. Off you go. You say, all right, I'm picking you because I think you're going to be good, but I'm picking you to be on my squad for the next 12 months, the next 3 years, you know, the AIS programs, you're in there for the next 5 years. College programs, I'm picking you for a four-year contract, essentially. So there's so many things that go into it. And I think that coach bias, that coach heuristics is a really important part that we shouldn't discount and we shouldn't try to get rid of. I think we need to acknowledge it and we need to work with it, not against it.
Yeah. So when we start looking at talent ID, for example, how hard is it to pick someone at 12 versus picking someone at 17 as to what their projection is going to look like, where they're going to end up and those kinds of things?
I mean, as with any prediction, the closer to the event that we're making the prediction, the easier it's going to be. Think about it like weather forecasting. If I'm predicting the weather tomorrow, I'm going to be, you know, 90% accurate, even me not a, you know, a meteorologist with no knowledge. I can look outside now, say, yeah, it's pretty sunny. I look over in the east. Yeah, there's no clouds coming in. It'll probably be a sunny day tomorrow too. We can do that. But judging for next year, all I can say is that, well, it's pretty warm right now, so it'll probably be pretty warm next year. And so on and so on. The further out we get, the less data we have and the more of a guess that forecast is. So in terms of identifying an athlete at 12 versus 17, obviously the forecast we make at 17 is going to be more accurate just because we're closer to them being 21, 22 NBA drafts, all that kind of thing. That's not to say I don't think we should be doing talent ID, talent selection earlier. I think we just need to be, again, aware of those limitations and not turn around and say, well, this person who is now 17 wasn't picked in the 12-year-old squad, so we're not going to pick them now in the 17-year-old.
Yep. And it really does give the inclination that you need to cast that net fairly wide the younger they are. Like, you can be a little bit more selective, I suppose, as they start to get a little bit older, but in that those younger age groups, who knows what these kids are going to turn out like? Who knows who's had their growth spurt, who's been an early maturer, those kinds of things that make a real difference with talent identification.
Yeah. And I mean, depending on the level we're working at, sometimes we can tell if a kid's had their growth spurt. If you know the kid, you're going to know if they've been through it or not. But that isn't to tell you whether something's going to happen or not. You know, there's genetic freaks happen. People happen to be a lot shorter or a lot taller than their parents. And then there's all the stuff around generalization that we talked about earlier. So athletes who maybe aren't super skilled at basketball, but they're also playing soccer at the same time and a bit of cricket and maybe some track or something like that, that all of a sudden they turn 15, 16, and then they start to connect the dots and they start to connect some of the skills that they've learned in these other sports back to basketball. And all of a sudden their basketball just takes off, which kids that have been talent selected since they were 12 often end up just specializing in basketball early. So miss out on those advantages. So they might be very, very basketball skilled, but they don't have that lateral thinking that's so important in a game situation.
Yeah, a little bit off topic, but sort of not off topic by the same token. Like, is there any good age to start high-performance programs for athletes? Like, is there such thing as too early? Well, obviously, don't want to specialize as a seven-year-old in one certain sport, but how early is too early?
I'm a big fan of constant generalization. I think it's really important that even our top-level athletes are doing some other sport that's not necessarily based on conditioning. You know, again, our basketball players, they'll often go and, you know, they'll do their 5K run or their swim or whatever, but they're not doing that to enjoy another sport, to develop skills in another sport. They're doing it, you know, for rehab or for fitness or whatever. But I think it's really, really important to allow those athletes the opportunity to play other sports, whether it's during their off season. You know, yes, basketball and a lot of sports now are year round. You can play all the time, but it's so important to even adult athletes to be playing those other sports. It reduces our overuse injury. It fosters creativity and just that enjoyment. A lot of times athletes are getting burnt out, not because of the physical and mental load necessarily, but just because they've lost the fun and enjoyment. It's no fun anymore. It's now a job. Whereas if we're playing another sport as well, that can remind us why we're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a really interesting spot because everyone wants their piece of the pie. Like if we have a talented athlete that comes through, we probably want them as basketball. Football probably want them as that. Their school wants their pound of flesh as well because they're on scholarship there. It's really difficult to have them to try and serve all the masters, so to speak. And that specialization can be really dangerous for those athletes because that's when the burnout happens. And we sort of probably find it mentally more than anything else. The bodies will hold up, but it's more the mental side of things where they need to go and do something else, just to have a little bit of a break from it.
Yeah, and having fun with your friends. You know, yeah, you can be an elite level basketball player and still go have a kick of the footy with your mates on the weekend.
Yep, absolutely. Just make sure you don't do it around any AFL scouts. We don't want to lose all our kids to AFL. Like we do have to be a little bit careful that we do want to keep some of the basketballs, but it is that thing. They need the break as well. And, you know, maybe not so much at the moment when we're in this sort of COVID time where everyone's not playing any sport, but there's certainly the argument between generalisation and specialisation. Like, I would much prefer kids to go and play soccer or something like that because there's no question that footwork will help with their ability to play basketball. Even the scanning of understanding who's on the pitch, where the space is, those kinds of things will help our athletes when they get into a confined space playing basketball as well. Like it's a really important side of things. So we spoke a little bit about the bias and coaches trying to sort of pick people that suit them. Is it difficult in a coaching sense when you need to have such a wide variety of players in basketball that you can't just pick all the tall kids or you can't just pick all the point guards? Like, is it more difficult for a basketball coach when they have so many variables they have to take into account there?
I mean, yes and no. So most of my research has been done on combat sports is where I did most of my PhD research. So that's all, you know, individual sports, which can be very different. You know, in combat sports, they've got weight categories. And in combat sports, you can't hide. I'm going to use the word hide. You can't hide behind someone else's strengths to cover your own weaknesses, things like that. But in team sports, you can be more reliant on a team. You know, sure, there's only five players on the court at once, but you can have one of those five players that maybe isn't as good a shot as the others, but they're incredibly good at reading the play, at screening, at defense, at whatever else you need them to be good at. You don't need five shooters that are able to hit, you know, a three-pointer every time. That's just a waste of playing space, really. So, you know, I think that makes things, again, easier in some sense, but it also makes it harder because as, you know, as a basketball coach, I'm sitting there and I might go, all right, you know, I'm looking at my 50 athletes that I'm selecting of and I'm, you know, picking 12 of these for my squad. But the best five players are all point guards. That doesn't really help me. There's no point picking five of my 12 players that all play the same position and maybe only play that position. So then I'm forced between choosing the best possible athletes versus the best possible team. So I think that's something that's really important for coaches to consider at all levels is it's not just about a particular athlete. It's about how they fit in with the group. Sometimes it can be a really valuable exercise for coaches to pick the athlete that, you know, again, we're picking 12 athletes, picking the athlete that's actually number 20 on your list as far as skills and physicality, but they bring something to the team. Maybe they're a leader. Maybe they're the jokester that makes everybody feel good. When you're developing a squad, it is worth looking at those other things that aren't just about physicality. We can teach a lot of skills. You know, sure, we can't make somebody taller, but we can teach somebody how to play with the height they've got.
And even just their personalities, you can't just have a team full of introverts. That's going to cause you so many problems as a coach. And conversely, you don't want a team full of extroverts. You need that.
Yeah, exactly. A team full of leaders does nobody any good.
No, exactly right. But how would you find that out in a trial situation where people are jumping on court and you're trying to evaluate their basketball talent? How do you try and find that balance?
I mean, really interesting question. The ideal world answer is that we see them more often. You know, my sort of mantra when it comes to talent ID, as you said earlier, it's casting a wide net. I like to say, you know, more athletes in front of more coaches more often. Because as we said earlier, coaches have their own little biases about what they're picking. So maybe you've got an athlete that didn't get picked by you, but I would pick them. So by getting them in front of more coaches, we get that opportunity to see different sides of an athlete because coaches are looking for different things. So as far as how we do it in that group situation, you know, all right, I've got, you know, 5 hours to evaluate all of these athletes and pick my squad. It's really hard to do. My advice in that situation would be to put them through as many different scenarios as possible. So that means not just seeing them in gameplay. Obviously gameplay is important, but when we're picking athletes, we're not just picking them for how well they're performing now. We're picking them for how much they're going to improve, for how well they're going to work as a team. So putting them in those difficult situations, seeing how they respond to coaching, actually going out and giving them a tip and seeing how they respond to that, whether they integrate it or just throw it away or whatever. Again, if you've only got 5 hours, that's going to be hard to do. But I think it's something that's very important to do is not just go, all right, I've got 5 hours, so we'll play 3 round-robin matches and call it a day. Yep. There needs to be some more of this technical stuff in there. Again, we don't want to judge based purely on technical, but we want to look at their coachability, how well they respond to being coached, how well they're going to develop as part of the team. Because as far as I see it, that's my differentiation when I'm picking a team. You know, if I've got two that are about the same, I'm going to pick the one that's more receptive to my coaching, the one that I think I can improve, even if they may be 2 steps below the next athlete above them. If I think I can take that athlete 5 steps above, I'm going to do that rather than take my one that's better now, but I can't do anything with.
And that's part of the joy of coaching, I suppose, is that we all have probably not overinflated views of our own ability by any means, but we've certainly always come across an athlete where it's like, geez, they've had a little bit of a troubled past where they haven't really fit in with that coach, or they haven't really done what they've needed to there. They might be a little bit loose with the ball or something like that, but maybe I can change them. Maybe I'll be the catalyst that will get that athlete over the line and make that adaption. But do we always have enough time? Like, if you're picking a team for a tournament, it is very different having to pick a team for a season, because you've obviously got a little bit more leeway in a season to be able to try and ride through those ebbs and flows, where if it's a tournament in 2 weeks, you don't have that time.
Exactly. It's all about that context. So, yeah, if you're asking me, again, to identify athletes, my first question is going to be, all right, what am I identifying them for? Like, am I picking them for something now? Am I picking them for a development squad? Or do you simply want me to point at 3 athletes and say, yep, in 10 years, they'll be good? Like, what do you want me to do with this? And yeah, that's going to impact us because if I'm picking a team to compete in 2 weeks, I don't care about your development capacity. I care about how well you play right now with these 5 guys with you.
Yep. And so when we start talking about the coach's eye and gut feel and those kinds of things, well, how would a rubric go in terms of talent identification versus, no, I'm not going to write down anything. I'm not going to have data and sliders. I'm just going to go off my gut feel and what it looks like.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been some research into this idea of, you know, rubrics or checklists and things like that. Basically what it's shown is that if we use a rubric, what it does is it puts all coaches on the same page. So they're all looking for exactly the same information, which on the surface sounds like a good thing. But what it means is that we lose a lot of our creativity. We lose a lot of, you know, the coach being able to be like, you know what, that kid doesn't tick any of these boxes, but there's just something about him. Okay. We've all had that athlete, or we've all heard that story of, you know, the athlete that didn't, you know, everything said they wouldn't be very good, but they kept getting chances. They kept getting picked. They kept having people believe in them, and they ended up making it to the top level or whatever. When we have a rubric, we lose some of that creativity and flexibility. The other issue we run into with a rubric is that it's all down to interpretation. So if we look at, you know, some of Basketball Victoria's policies, so, you know, 1v1 defense. Okay, what is that? What does that look like? What is good versus bad? How do we actually evaluate that? Because that in itself is a fairly subjective requirement. Decision-making. That is incredibly subjective. We can have it on our rubric and we can say, you know, like, makes good decisions under pressure. What is a good decision? Like, I'm going to have a very different opinion to you on what made a good decision in whatever scenario we're looking at. So rubrics sound like a good idea on the surface. And I think especially for younger coaches or for less experienced coaches, they're a really good starting point because they at least remind you of all the things to consider. So I kind of view, not necessarily a rubric as being a good idea, but again, a checklist, something like that. You know, have you considered their offensive skills, their defensive skills, just all that kind of thing? And then as far as, you know, weighting is another big part of a rubric. What's more important? You know, if I have a really short player that meets all of these requirements, should I pick them or not? Well, that's up to you as an individual coach is sort of how I see that. That's where I see that idea of that coach bias, those heuristics, that coach's eye fitting in with our more objective measures. I think it's important that we have some sort of objective thing we're judging off. There needs to be some accountability for coaches. We can't just let them run wild and pick whoever they want with absolutely no oversight, because that's the quickest way we end up with a completely biased team. But at the same time, we need to allow coaches that freedom of being able to pick the athletes that they can work with, that can work within their own constraints. And again, meeting whatever we've set out for them to do. So Basketball Victoria, Basketball Australia, whatever they've said my job is as a coach for right now.
Makes sense. And how much does that sort of bias come into things like gender? Obviously, boys and girls basketball, same sport, but played very differently. Male and female coaches, still a coach, but potentially coach very differently as well. Does gender play a part in particular if it's a female coach coaching male athletes or a male coach coaching female athletes?
Well, I don't have any evidence on that. We actually haven't done that research yet, which if anybody at Basketball Victoria is keen on that, hit me up. Evidence-based, no. But from my gut feeling, I would say yes, there is. If we consider what we know about a lot of just sports science research in general, most of it's been done on men. And the general assumption is that, you know, women are just small men. We know that that's not the case anymore. It's starting to come out more and more that you can't just coach a women's team in the same way you would coach a men's team, even though it is the same sport. So as far as coach bias in picking these athletes, I think it has to be there. Male coaches who have played the male version of the game are going to be picking female athletes based on the male attributes that they would want as part of the game, and vice versa. Often female coaches, I imagine, would be picking male athletes based more on the skills that they require to be good in the female game. Potentially less likely with female coaches picking male athletes just because the male version of basketball is so much more dominant, just in culture and things like that, grown up watching it, all that kind of thing. Particularly when picking athletes, I think we find it's, much more of a lack of understanding of what is actually required to play at that level in those sports.
And so how do you fill that bucket, so to speak? If you have that lack of an understanding, are you better off having say a female coach coaching males, are you better off having a male assistant coach or vice versa? Does that help, or is it more conversations with the athletes and style around how they play?
I think it's kind of all of the above. More diversity can never help hurt. So if we've got, you know, a female head coach, I think it is a good idea to try and match them with a male assistant coach, and vice versa. If we've got a male head coach, I think it's even more important then to get a female assistant coach in there just to give that different perspective, regardless of the gender of athletes that they're coaching. And I don't think we should, you know, turn around and say, well, you know, only women should coach women's teams and only men should coach men's teams. That's a very slippery slope that we don't want to get into. But I think it's more, again, just that awareness. I'm going to be very stereotypical and broad here, but in general, men don't understand the nuances of the women's game because men watch men's basketball. They played men's basketball. They think that their version of basketball is the only version. Whereas women, again, grow up with the men's version. They've often played with their older brothers, especially young kids in regional areas. They'll play on the boys' teams growing up. So they have a lot better understanding of the men's game as well as the women's game. So again, this is all just me basing off my experience. There is no evidence behind this. But that's kind of how I see it, that I think it's really important to just bring in that diversity and raise that awareness. There's nothing wrong with having a male coach a women's team, but he needs to be aware of those differences. He needs to be very explicit in being able to explain what those differences are and how he's adjusting his coaching style for that group of players.
It's a real interesting topic, you know. Like, it's something I'm really curious about, because we do have a real lack of female coaches, and we certainly need to be aware of that and how we can get more female coaches into the sport. And whole different topic involved in that about, you know, making it a safer place and all those kinds of things as well. But it's really interesting, because we do have a lot of male coaches that coach female athletes. And they, to be honest, they do it out of goodness of their heart. They had a daughter that played, so they jump in, and that's just where they start and where they continue. They've potentially never coached male basketball. And that's not a bad thing. It's just circumstance more than anything else.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's something that, like, is worth me saying now, is that I don't think you need to have played to be a good coach. I don't think you need to have played anywhere near the level you're coaching, or even the sport at all, in order to be a good coach. Obviously, that sporting knowledge is important, but you can develop that just as well from coaching your daughter's team from, you know, under fives all the way through, as you can of having played yourself from under fives all the way through. So I think that's really important, especially when we're talking about this, you know, gender equity in coaching. A lot of people turn around and say, well, women haven't played at that level, so they can't coach. Doesn't matter. Yep. If they have that background knowledge and they are good coaches, they'll be able to handle it. If you're that worried, bring in a male assistant coach. Don't just discount women in coaching roles.
Absolutely. And look, I'm certainly not suggesting I'm a good coach, but I was 100% a hack basketballer. Like, there is absolutely no validity in you have to be talented at basketball to have a coaching career. It's in all honesty, it's just a love of the sport. Like, I enjoy basketball, so I wanted to be more and more involved, and I scratched the itch by being more involved in things as well. And I think that's really important for a lot of coaches to understand, is there's no closed doors there. Like, go and watch someone else's training session, or ask more questions and sort of build a little bit of knowledge there. Even if you haven't played the sport, there are ways to find this out. Like, there's a lot of different things you can do there. When we were looking at, say, forecasting of athletes, how long does it take to get a really accurate guide as to what you're looking at in front of you? Is that a, look, I can see someone for 30 seconds, see how they move, and I'm pretty comfortable with that? Or is that a longer-term proposition?
Everybody's favorite answer. It depends.
Yep.
So a couple of things there. First thing is use of the word accurate. As I said earlier, we've got no way of knowing whether these decisions are accurate or not. You know, we can get into it in a little bit if you want to, but there's all these, you know, self-fulfilling prophecies, and there's all these external factors that can affect whether an athlete we've selected makes it or not. And, you know, even what level is making it, but that's a whole nother discussion. So as far as, yeah, being accurate, we can never know whether our decisions were accurate or not. It would take millions of dollars and a 30-year study to do. Nobody's going to give me that money, unfortunately. Again, if there's anyone out there listening to this podcast that has that money, happy to take you up on it. But as far as how long does it take? 30 seconds. For a lot of coaches, I can look at an athlete, you know, even just walking in the door, and I can get a pretty good impression of them as a person. You know, are they ready to go? Do they have their water bottle full? Are they, you know, listening to their iPod and talking to their friends, or are they really focused, or whatever? We're forming those judgments all the time. It's an inherent thing that we can't help but do. So there's no necessarily shortest amount of time, but as far as being able to actually make a reliable judgment. So, you know, when I say reliable, I'm talking about if I were to see you today and then see you under the same circumstances in 6 months, I'd make the same decision twice. In order to do that, we really need to see, again, those athletes in as many different scenarios as possible. So one of my PhD studies, we actually asked a bunch of judo coaches to look at athletes over a four-day camp, and we had them rate the athletes in basically order from 1 to 25 of these 25 athletes, morning and evening throughout the whole camp. And we were trying to answer that question: how long does it take for them to decide on an athlete's talent? What we found was that by the end of the camp, 9 coaches only agreed on 2 athletes. There were only 2 athletes that they even put in the same third. Okay. And that was the top 2 athletes. They said, yep, these 2 are definitely in the top third. All the rest were completely mixed. So you couldn't even get them in a half as being the same athlete. And when we looked, you know, day to day, again, there were only 2 athletes that stayed sort of in the top third, only moving 1 or 2 rankings. All the rest went from 25 to 3 to 10 to 11 to, you know, 25 again over the course of 4 days. So the more we know about the athletes, the more uncertain we get in making those long-term decisions, which is probably a good thing, because it makes us less likely to jump on those first impressions. If we have to, it's there. If I've only got 5 hours to make my decision, I can do it in that time. Any coach is able to do it in that time. But if we want to make sure, again, that it's reliable, so I would pick the same athlete again under the same scenario, or that you and I would both pick the same athlete, which is another big part of it. We need a really long time to do that. Like, we're probably talking a couple of months of seeing these athletes fairly regularly, which, again, I know is not necessarily feasible in a lot of these circumstances, but it is something that we need to consider. If you're going to be making selections for a state team, it's not enough just to watch the state tournament. You need to be attending training sessions. You need to be seeing video of these athletes, just seeing the athletes in as many different scenarios as you can for the longest period of time. I know that's not a great answer, but that's where we're at with the research at the moment.
That's the perfect answer, because I can guarantee if we told coaches you got 6 months to pick a team, they would take all 6 months to pick the team. Like, it's just what we do. We want to try and have as much information as we possibly can in that situation as well. So when we're coming into, in theory, we're coming into a trial period of the year, all things being equal, how difficult is it to judge an athlete that we've potentially only seen two or three times over the last 12 to 18 months? We have an opinion on who and what they are. Then they come in on the back of COVID where we haven't seen them for so long. How hard is it to dispel the mental breakdown of what we have of that athlete and then have a fresh set of eyes, so to speak, when assessing them?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. A couple of different things, and I'm going to come back to something that I've said a couple of times, which is really just around awareness, just having coaches be aware that they potentially have these biases or these heuristics going on. And it's probably a good time to talk about some of those self-fulfilling prophecies that I mentioned earlier. So when we talk talent ID, there's two main kinds of self-fulfilling prophecy that we see happen over and over again. The first one is called the Matthew effect. And it basically says that the rich get richer. So, you know, age 11 is our first, you know, regional level selection event for basketball, say. And at our under 11s regional team, kid A gets picked, but kid B doesn't. Come next year, and we're picking our under 12 team, well, kid A that got picked last year is probably going to have some slightly better skills, maybe a little better fitness, because they've been doing the extra sessions, they've been having the extra coaching, all that kind of stuff. You had an extra tournament or two's worth of experience. So then when it comes time for selection in the under 12s, athlete A is going to be marginally better than athlete B. So athlete A is going to get picked again. And then that gap just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger every time we have a selection event. And so that kid that doesn't get picked the first time never then gets another chop at it unless they're working extra hard doing other things. So that's something we need to be aware of as coaches when we're looking at, especially those younger age groups, is where it makes a huge difference, is that, am I picking this kid because he has better skills? If the answer to that is yes, well, then look just a little bit deeper. Why do they have better skills? Is that because they were picked last year and got to develop in that team? And then, you know, again, taking a step back as a coach, all right, are they a season's worth of regional representation better, or are they more than that? Like, where is that differentiation so that we're not just picking the same kids over and over again because they happen to be the kids that got picked last year? So that's one of these self-fulfilling prophecies. The other one is something called the Pygmalion effect, which is where I, as a coach, have picked you because I believe that you're going to be really good one day. And I keep telling you that over and over and over again. So I, as a youth athlete, go, all right, cool. I'm going to be good one day. I'm going to put in the extra work and the extra effort and go to the extra training sessions and try out for this team and that team and play travel ball and whatever else. Whereas, again, athlete B on the same team that's never had the coach say, I think you could be good one day, doesn't, because they haven't had that little piece of incentive that they needed to kick them up a notch. So, again, if our athlete is that much better, is that because that's someone that you've been paying more attention to during training or has had that extra external feedback from somewhere? As coaches, that's not always something we can know, especially if we've got a new player in. We don't know these things about their background. But a lot of the athletes we do, or we at least have some idea or can do research. We can talk to other coaches. We can talk to the home coach or the school coach or whatever and find out the answers to these questions. Again, knowing that the Matthew effect is in play or the Pygmalion effect is in play isn't necessarily going to change a decision. And I'm not saying we should turn around and not pick athlete A when they are significantly better than athlete B, even if the Matthew effect is the reason. I'm just saying, again, we need to be aware of that. If coaches are aware that these things are at play, then we can take that step back and actually make a selection based, again, on the potential of the athlete, not on the previous opportunities that an athlete's already had.
Yep. So working on the theory that every athlete is the same and every coach is not the same, and every coach is absolutely not the same, how important is adaptability in coaching styles with the athletes as well? Like, there are certain players that obviously suit your style really well and certain players that potentially don't. How important, when you're not going to leave out a talented athlete because they simply don't suit your style, how important is it for the coaches to be able to adapt in that situation?
I mean, I think that depends on the level. Like you just said, you wouldn't leave an athlete out because they don't miss your style. Some coaches do, especially when we get into sort of that, you know, like national level squads and stuff like that. You might be the most talented athlete in the room, but you know, you're one player out of my whole squad. And if you as one player are going to bring down the rest of my team, or you're not going to respond to my coaching and potentially set a bad example for the other athletes, all that kind of thing, I might not pick you. But again, that's a personal preference based on the coach. And again, what our outcome is, do we want to win the tournament or do we want to develop long-term? But as far as being able to adapt our coaching styles, I think that's, again, part of that art of coaching. It's our responsibility as coaches to make sure that we are reaching as many athletes in our team as possible. Sometimes there is just going to be a clash that just cannot be solved. And at that point, I believe it's our responsibility as coaches to move that athlete into a more suitable environment. It's not, I can't handle you and you're stuck on my team, so I'm just going to ignore you for the season or drive you out of the sport or whatever happens there. It's, hey, we're not meshing, or perhaps talking to the parent. Hey, you know, like our styles just aren't meshing here. I'm doing my best, but it's just not working. Perhaps your child would be better off at a different club or in a different team. You know, you go and approach a, you know, I've done this before in hockey. You go and approach the coach of the next region over and, hey, really talented kid, but I can't do anything with them. They're just not fitting here, but I know your style and I think they might fit better there. So again, that's obviously blue sky thinking. But I think when we're looking development, that's a really important aspect. Coaches aren't going to be able to reach everybody. Athletes have to meet us halfway and try to, you know, work with us within our styles, but sometimes that's just not going to happen. So that's when I think, yeah, we need to get to know other coaches and be able to use them as resources so that we can keep these athletes in the system, keep them developing, but we're not stuck pulling our hair out, banging our head against the wall because this really talented athlete just isn't responding to us.
Yep. So In what you've seen so far, how important is the role of the grassroots coach and the volunteer coach to the whole pathway? I've got a real passion for coaching younger athletes, under 8s, under 10s, under 12s. I think that's where a lot of the fun is. And if they have a good first experience in the sport, they're more likely to stay in the sport. What have you seen around that sort of space as well?
I would 100% agree. I think that grassroots and volunteer coaches, you know, that school level, primary school level, absolutely integral. Without those coaches, we don't have high performance. If we don't get athletes in at a young age, as you said, enjoying themselves, then they're just going to quit no matter how good they could have been. So yeah, our whole high performance system, elite sport, just disappears if we don't have grassroots. All you have to do is look at some of those other sports out there that aren't lucky to have a robust youth system. You know, again, I look at combat sports. That's where I've spent most of my time. Boxing is not something that a lot of people enroll their 8-year-old to do. As a result, at the top end, we don't have a massive depth of competition. You know, but we look at swimming, we look at basketball, we look at netball. We've got some of the best teams in the world and some of the best athletes in the world because we have such a robust youth system that we're getting our athletes in. So yeah, I completely think that those coaches, grassroots volunteers, you know, under 12s, anything up to that age, are the absolute bedrock. And I think we need to spend more time developing those coaches. I think we need to put, not incentives, but we need to get better coaches into those roles. We need to incentivize grassroots coaching, under 12s, under 10s, in the same way we do that high performance coaching. We shouldn't have all of our best coaches at the top end, because at that point, they're done developing. We need to develop the younger athletes.
Absolutely. And you've actually probably answered my next question. So what sort of things that can actually help with coach development that you've seen in your studies?
Yeah, probably accessibility is the main one. You know, these coaching courses, they're fairly ubiquitous, but they're very expensive, which, you know, the organizations have to make money. I understand all the logistic issues. But, you know, a lot of these coaches aren't getting their level one certification, aren't upskilling themselves because of the time and the money involved. I think organizations need to find the money. Again, I know it's easier said than done, but find the money to incentivize coach development. Find the find some way to encourage coaches to go out and seek their own development opportunities. Come along to webinars. Even things like setting up an intra-club mentoring system. Perhaps your Division I men's coach goes along to junior practices once a month to help out with the coaches. So there's all sorts of different things in there. Just again, making that coach development more accessible to people. I sit there. Obviously I'm fairly experienced in coaching and now I teach coaching. But I never took my level 2 coaching course. I did my level 1 because that was required, but I never did level 2 because it was, $600 for a 2-day course that I already felt I knew everything in doing. Similar thing in other courses. I've never taken my level 1 hockey coaching course, even though I've been coaching hockey since I was 12. I've never bothered because I thought I knew it all and it was money that I didn't need to spend. While now I sit there and go, actually, I didn't know as much as I thought I did. You don't know that until you do it, right? So finding other ways to get that coach development to people that's not strictly accreditation courses and just making it, more fun, more applicable to their environments, even cross sport things, finding opportunities for grassroots sports coaches to talk to one another. So netball and basketball and hockey and soccer and footy and whatever, perhaps all the ones in your region do a coach development thing together. That networking can be a really important aspect of coach development.
Excellent. Dr. Alex Roberts, La Trobe University, thank you very much for jumping onto the podcast. The Coach's Eye is your thesis, which is available online, and we'll link to that in the show notes as well if anyone's keen to have a look at it. Really appreciate your time today. I know it's in lockdown and you've got a million things going on at the moment, but thank you very much for jumping in the podcast, and hopefully we'll see you around a little bit more in the coaching scene.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So we'll link to the paper in the show notes for anyone that's interested on Alex's thesis there. You can also follow Alex on @AlexHRoberts on Twitter, and you can look into the Women's Coaches Association @coaching_women's. Just a bit of a reminder for everyone as well, we are looking to have a mailbag episode coming up, so make sure you get any questions in that you want asked of the high performance team or myself, and we'll get to those as soon as we possibly can, and hopefully get something out in one of the following podcasts. Stay safe and stay healthy, everyone, and we'll hopefully see you back on court soon.
Look, tune in and join the tribe on iTunes and Spotify. Put this basketball coaching on the next level. Pat them to the